I've taken kids to like Brussels, Paris, Rabat, Morocco, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Jakarta. I mean, we've gone all over the place. And the kids meet all these students from other cities, from other cultures, and they get together for 3-4 days and they work together. And like the name implies, they walk away with friends. They have made musical friendships from around the world.
From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Chetmore with The Listen, exploring the subtleties of culture and compassion in every conversation. Today, we kick off season 18, a series of interviews focusing on music. If you know me, you know music has played a central role in my life from the very beginning, and I know I'm not alone. Whether it's the human voice, a single instrument, or a full orchestra under the baton of a renowned conductor, music has the power to touch us like no other art form. My guest today, Brian White, is a 24-year veteran in the music classroom, with the bulk of that experience coming from band directing positions in Saudi Arabia and Singapore. He recently moved to Milan, Italy, and is enjoying his new role as the director of bands at the American School of Milan. His wife is also a teacher, and it was her semester studying abroad in college that inspired the two to look abroad for teaching opportunities. Their son is a true third culture kid, having been born in Singapore and raised on three continents. Welcome to the show, Brian. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kate, for having me. I really appreciate it. This is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. So 24 years in the classroom, that's not too shabby. I'm curious because as a musician, I mean, that's one label, and a teacher is quite another label. I mean, I don't know if you really go for labels, but if you had to choose, how would you define yourself?
I am totally a teacher. I mean, I enjoy performing, but that's never been my goal. Long story, but I kind of fell into going to music school. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I was applying to colleges, and I ended up at a college that had a great music program, and I just wanted to take some private lessons to keep playing. And I did an audition for that, and they said, hey, you know, you're pretty good. If you want to be a music major, we can give you more money. I was like, oh, more money? Sure.
Twist my
so,
arm.
Right. So I kind of fell into that, but I did not come from a good high school music program. I was way behind. And like fourth week of school, my trumpet teacher, I mean, laid it all on the line for me, really brutally honest. And I was just bawling in the lesson. And he's just like, if you want to be a great band director, you have to be a great musician first. And I don't know, that just resonated with me. And my next 3 years was about building up those skills. And I got done. And I knew I couldn't be a music performer. I was not at that level. But I knew I wanted to teach, but I still didn't feel ready to teach. So I started going to grad school to get a performance degree with the idea of using those skills to help me to teach better. So to go back to your original, yeah, I'm a teacher. I'm a music teacher. I use my performance skills that I've learned to help me to teach better. And it's totally worked out. My first, I'm sure every music teacher's first job, you know, they're staring at 100 kids staring back at them and it's like, oh my God, what do I do? you rely on those musicians, you know, you start rehearsing and things aren't working and you go back to, well, what did we do when I was, you know, having a hard time with that thing, and it totally helped.
Do you agree with what your professor said about, you know, you have to be a great musician before you can be a great band teacher?
Yes, totally. The bulk of that 24 years, I did 6 years in high school and then 17 in teaching middle school. Mm. And, you know, there's very different expectations with high school and middle school musicians. And I mean, being an excellent musician, I feel, also means not just knowing, you know, how to read scores and to analyze pieces, but it's like, oh yeah, an F on the flute is this, kids. And and know that because you've played it, you've worked on it, you've learned it, you know all the instruments. So I've taken a lot of time studying all of the instruments so that when a kid's having a problem, I can go, you know what? You're having a problem because of XYZ. And I know that because I had the same problem trying to learn that. So totally, totally agree with what he said.
Was that a conscious decision to switch from high school to middle school? Because as you said, I mean, that's a very different human being you're dealing with.
It was at the time I'd been doing high school, like I said, 6 years, which isn't a lot of time, but high school band directing is exhausting in the States because it's marching band, it's pep band, it's, you know, all the extra rehearsals after school for all those things, all the weekends, the competitions. And after 6 years, honestly, I was like on the verge of like, I can't do this. I don't see my family. I was driving. The school was right next to our airport, but I lived an hour away from that. So I'm driving an hour, you know, each way. And then all the extra rehearsals, I wasn't seeing my family. And so we decided at that point to look, you know, to try to go in another direction. And that's when the international teaching came into play. And we went to a recruiting fair, and there was a fifth grade brass band instructor / general music. And when I went to the interview, it turned out it was mostly general music. And then I would teach one fifth grade class per day of brass. And then there was another teacher that would do woodwinds. Funny story, at the recruiting fair, I happened to interview, they had two positions available. One was the woodwind instructor and one was the brass. And I happened to interview first, and I'm a brass player. I mean, I play woodwinds, but that's my main instrument. And so is the other teacher. But because I interviewed first, I got the brass job.
Oh, so you got to choose.
Yeah, I got to choose. So that kind of lucked out. But anyway, so that was like general music, which, you know, K through five. And at first I was like, yeah, it's a great chance to go overseas, but it's general, you know, it's much younger kids. Mm-hmm. But I cherish that. I only spent a year there before they moved me into another position. But I cherish that year because, again, I go back to the basics. What is it that I will try to be teaching the kids or, you know, later on as they progress? How do I get them there? Well, I've got to start here as a kindergartner teaching, you know, steady beat and you know, recognizing pitches, matching pitches, and then the progression through that to eventually, oh, now I have them in fifth grade and I get to teach them instruments. So, and that happened again when I moved to Saudi. I moved there and I was in a 1 year general music position, K through five. And it was a great review of, you know, basic fundamental skills that kids need to know before you start teaching them the instrumental skills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, let's jump into now the part of your career, which you're still in, which is teaching overseas. You are an international teacher.
Correct.
So, I mean, obviously, when you made that change, you were not only moving overseas, you were also moving from high school to elementary and middle school, as you said. But let's take a step back from that change, the age range change, and talk about culture. What were the major differences that you experienced between teaching in the American system and teaching in the international system?
Good question. Well, the biggest thing, there's no marching band or pep band overseas. That was really.
I'm guessing you don't miss that.
No, sorry. I know there's probably some listeners that are like, marching band is amazing, but. It was never my thing. I didn't have a great marching band experience in high school. My undergrad didn't have a marching band. And like I said, I really don't like American football, so having to go to the football games every week. But no, there's no marching band overseas, or very rarely. But as far as the students go, the schools that I've taught at, I've had the I don't want to say luck, you know, because it took hard work to get there, but the privilege of working at have been very well-established private American institutions with a client base that the students tend to come from well-supported, you know, two-parent families that have the resources. So when I'm like, okay, kids, it's time to buy an instrument, you should really get a wooden buffet clarinet. And the parents are like, okay, you know, and that's like 2,000 U.S. dollars, as opposed to, you know, teaching in the States. Sometimes it was like, I don't have any working instruments for you to play, so you guys are going to have to share this one. I'll get you another mouthpiece. Mm. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, when I worked for Saudi Aramco, you know, it is an oil company, so we would have enough instruments to give kids one for home and one for school, like on the big tubas and euphoniums.
Wow.
And we're talking really good quality, you know, new instruments. So,
wow.
I mean, that aspect, the financial aspect was really nice. The students are very, again, it's a private institution. They come from great families. They're generally hard workers.
Hmm.
And this is a really hard comparison because, again, in the States, I was mostly high school. And overseas, I've been mostly middle school. So I'm not sure if the comparison works here, but I feel like I'm still closer to some of the high school students than I ever got with some of the middle school. And that's probably just the age range. Those high schoolers in the States, you know, while they may not come from as privileged families, some of them would get way more invested in music and treat the band program as a family.
Mm.
And have an emotional connection to me and to the students in that class, because it was their like saving grace. It was their thing they could do at school that they could latch onto and be like, I'm good at this and I have fun at this.
Whereas it almost sounds like their social group.
You know?
Like there's the theater group and the super duper academic group and then the band.
Yeah, well, we can go. You could say it, the band geeks. We can be. And there is some of that overseas, but I don't know. It's not. And again, it's probably a middle school thing. They're just, you know, they're still trying to figure out who they are. But I never had that sense of like pride, you know, that you might get in a high school group like in the States. So that's a big difference between
teaching
overseas.
I know you've also been involved in international music festivals with an organization called, is it pronounced AMI?
Yeah, it's like the French word for friends.
Okay.
This is if any of your listeners are thinking about working overseas, this is a group they must check out and get involved with, especially coming from an American perspective where you have, you know, like you're working with your bands and you want to go to a festival or a concert festival or a state competition festival. Every state, every district, every city has that in the States. We don't have that overseas. You might be the only American style band in your city, country even. And so there was, I think it was like 25, 26 years ago, a couple, an American couple, Dick and Georgia Bassett, were teaching many places, but they ended up at the American School of London, and they said, you know, we really need to have a festival. And they did. Everyone loved it. And then another school heard about it and like, hey, can we join? And then they did. And then it was either the American School of Paris or maybe Brussels or the American School of The Hague heard about it. And they're like, hey, we'd like to get involved. And it just sort of snowballed. So they ended up having this high school festival that became international. And then they slowly added on some choral festivals, some middle school festivals. And now it's global. They run, and up until like 6 or 7 years ago, it was all run by teachers who, you know, they would volunteer their time to, you know, to help organize things. And even the festivals are still hosted by these international schools. So a teacher and their team of colleagues will say, hey, we're going to host this. And they do tons of work to get all the guests, musicians to come and perform. But they do like 18, 19 festivals a year. You know, COVID has made that. It was a big struggle with COVID. They had to cancel, you know, most of them. But now they also do solo ensemble festivals, and that's turned to like sort of online things where kids can submit. Again, and teachers volunteer their time to watch and score the performances. They also have a music educators conference that for a few years was meeting in person and going and learning from your colleagues. And it's been online the last 2 years, but I'm sure it'll go back to in person. But for the students, it's absolutely amazing because like from a middle school perspective, my students would audition with three or four set pieces. Those would get sent to a committee of, again, teachers that volunteered their time. They'd listen to them, rank them, and then select, you know, the top you know, however many musicians the hosting school could handle, those kids would get the invite. They'd work on the music at home, and then they'd finally get to come to the festival city. And I've taken kids to like Brussels, Paris, Rabat, Morocco, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Jakarta. I mean, we've gone all over the place, and the kids meet all these students from other cities, from other cultures, and they get together for 3-4 days, and they work together, and like the name implies, they walk away with friends. They have made musical friendships from around the world, and it's run by the most amazing people. It's non-for-profit. I can't speak highly enough of this organization.
It sounds amazing. I had never heard of this organization until you told me about it in the preparation for this interview. And I have to say, I checked out their website and it made me want to, you know, somehow get involved, somehow go. We're going to include the link to Ami in our show notes for anybody who wants to check that out. But for now, we need to take a quick break. We'll be right back to continue our conversation with my guest, musician Brian White. Back in a second. The Listen is proudly sponsored by IWBB Abroad. As women who move around the world, we're often looking for online communities. I actively engage in IWBB Abroad, a business Facebook group for women. If you want a supportive space where you can learn and move your business forward, come and join me. If you're enjoying this interview, check out the conversations in Season 1, in which all of my guests spoke about the experience of raising their children outside their own culture. You might also enjoy Season 13, in which we focused on American teachers abroad. You can explore our full archive by following us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or Spotify. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian White, who's talking about his career as an international music and band teacher. I'd love to take a moment to talk about culture. You and I are both American, and I'm guessing that we have a common understanding of jazz, of blues, of R&B, you know, the sort of typical American music styles. What about on the international scene? If you sit down and play jazz with people from other countries, do you feel like you're all speaking the same language?
Let's see. In some of the cities I've been in, yes. So my time in Singapore and Ecuador, I would agree. I did surround myself with like musicians that had studied that, so I feel like they had a prior knowledge of that music because they had listened to it and studied it. When I taught that with my middle schoolers, most of them hadn't listened to jazz or blues, and so it was all new to them. I'm finding also now in Milan, while working, I teach a rock band class and a guitar, two guitar classes, and I'm finding, and I include a blues unit in the guitar classes, and I ask the rock band to play at least one blues tune. It is not part of their knowledge base. And I'm finding the high school kids, their eyes start to glaze over a bit. And I'm trying to show them the connection between blues and jazz and the music that they listen to. But I, like you said, as an American, I mean, blues, jazz comes from blues. Blues comes from, you know, the music of an oppressed people. And I think you and I might, you know, be able to understand that not as deeply, obviously, as people from that culture, but I'm finding the students who aren't American, they have a hard time connecting with that and understanding that. Like when we listen to blues tunes and the lyrics are about, you know, the oppression and you would think it might ring true with something it hasn't yet. The adults that I've worked with, who, like I said, who've studied music, are more connected to that and have an understanding. And like I could say, okay, blues and F, and they're like, yeah, no problem. And they understand how to do that.
So does that lead you to think that sort of something's being lost with the current generation, or that they just haven't gotten there age-wise?
That's, another really interesting question. I'm finding in the guitar classes, the kids in band are there because they want to learn how to play an instrument. They want that social situation. The general music classes, like guitar, and like I teach a general sixth grade music class, they don't listen to music.
Huh.
In as much as they put on music, and kids don't buy albums anymore. They put on YouTube, and a playlist will just start running, and it'll just go to the next one, and they don't sometimes know what they're listening to, but the music's on. Mm-hmm. And it'll just play songs that they kind of enjoy. And when you mention, they might mention a song like, oh, I was listening to this the other day while doing homework. And then you start talking about other songs by that artist, and they're like, what? No, I don't. And oddly enough, too, the kids that do listen to music with intent to, you know, sit down and listen are listening to music that we grew up on. Like, when you start talking about some of the classic rock tunes, mm-hmm. they can go like, oh, yeah, I know that one.
Uh-huh. Do you think it's because they've sort of mined their parents' collection?
That's probably it. Mm-hmm. You know, their parents are suggesting things because, at least at my age, I'm almost 50, the students I'm teaching, their parents are about my age, too. So right. when I had a girl come in the other day and say, Mr. Wright, I'd really like to learn Run to You by Bryan Adams. And I was like, oh, my God. I listened to that at my middle school dance.
You know what's really funny, Brian? This is the first time you and I have ever spoken, and we're on Zoom, so most people will only hear the audio of this, but I'm looking at your face and I'm like, God, who does he look like? And I'm like, oh my God, all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, it's Bryan Adams. You just said Bryan Adams. And I'm like, that's who he looks like.
I've heard that one before. Yeah.
But, you know,
I'll take that. I think that's pretty good.
It is. But, you know, you're describing a dynamic, which I actually see as sort of a double dynamic. I have a son who's 14. I think you have a son who's a little bit younger than that. Is that right?
He's 12, yeah.
Okay. So fairly similar ages. And there's something I see. So a lot of what you're describing, I see in my son. Like, you know, he listens to music on Spotify. He listens to music on YouTube. He thinks it's totally old fashioned to see me like put a CD in a CD player, which was cutting edge technology when we were their age.
Right.
But so from my point of view, I'm like, you know, you don't know what you're missing. Like there's a richness to listening to the songs in order that were created to be played in that order, you know, and even on an LP, like there was a moment in the experience where you flip the disc over, right?
Yeah.
So that's my point of view. And then I know that his point of view, because he's told me this many times, is, you know, things have changed. This is the way the world is now. Like,
right.
Surrender to it, because there's good stuff about this too. And it sounds like as a teacher and as a dad that you're right in the middle of that too. You're also experiencing those two dynamics, you know?
Yeah. Well, and if I can extend that, you're totally right. Like the way that we listen to music, much different. The technology they have at their fingertips though, as far as music teaching goes, like when I teach my guitar class, I can immediately, like someone will bring something up and I'm like, oh, and I can go online really quick and immediately show them, like, this is what you were talking about. And the point of my guitar class really, because it's only a semester long, is to teach the kids all the resources they're going to need to teach themselves as soon as they're done. And nowadays, there's so many. And just like, you know, language teachers, English teachers and social studies teachers are trying to show kids how to navigate the web and Google searching and to find the right info, that's kind of what I do in the guitar class. Yes, we learn how to play songs. And I make my guitar class, the focus is like a pop rock. I know that at least at this school, the predecessor was more into the classical, like let's learn classical style, read notes. And, mm-hmm. and I think, no, kids want to learn how to strum some chords, and in the process of doing that, I'm going to show them how they can keep learning, and then eventually, if they really get into it, they'll teach themselves all that stuff anyway.
Right. Well, you know, the resources and the tools that you're describing are so important, because it really is true that as teachers and as parents, as adults, it's our responsibility to teach young people how to access those tools on their own, because they're going to be on their own before we know it, right?
Right. I totally agree.
What about when it comes to how music is accepted in general as an art style in other countries and other cultures? Have you run into any situations where music wasn't culturally acceptable?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So after Singapore, I spent 8 years working in Saudi Arabia for the Saudi Aramco Expatriate Schools, which is we are under the HR department of the Saudi Aramco Oil Company. It was only the students that went to the school were expatriates, and they were not Saudi citizens. So within my daily school life, I didn't feel as many restrictions because it was an American curriculum. Parents that sent their students to that school worked for the oil company, and they were under agreement that it's an American curriculum and music can be studied as an art form, as a core subject. We had all students taking band in grade five, and we had 270 kids at one point in grade five. And then that was another teacher. When they came to me, I had about 220 kids, grade six through nine. We only went to ninth grade. And as far as that goes, yes, we all studied instruments. We studied music. There were limitations on what we could play. No Christmas music whatsoever, nothing relating to the holidays. It made the choir teacher's job very difficult because, you know, like 80% of choral music is, you know, religious based. Maybe not 80%, but I'm making up that number. But a lot of it, you know, comes from the choral tradition of religious music. So that was an interesting component of that job. Outside of that community, we were a gated like city of 10,000-11,000 residents, where inside it was more Western, but outside we were on the east coast of Saudi Arabia. And for probably a good 6 or 7 years, music was considered haram and not to be played or heard in public. I don't know what happens behind closed doors, but you'd go into a restaurant, no background music. In the malls, no background music, nothing. And I have like a personal connection and experience with that because early on when I moved there, I got together with some other folks. We're like, hey, we'd really like to put together some sort of jazz group. And long story short, we ended up forming the Dahran Big Band, which, as far as we can tell with the research we have, it's the first jazz big band in the last 50 years. And it was made up of expats from Portugal, the UK, Norway, America, France, you know, all over. Mm. Unfortunately, we didn't have any Saudi citizens playing in the group. I mean, that's probably because it's not part of the culture, playing a band instrument. A little side offshoot, as far as a band director goes, like, we didn't have any instrument repair technicians in the whole country.
Wow.
So if an instrument broke, we had to fix it ourselves. So our company would fly in technicians once a year to work with us for 2 weeks, teaching us how to do that.
How to repair your own instruments.
How to repair instruments, because if it breaks, there's no one around to do it. So that was an interesting, again, kind of points to your question. But
what about, were you able to have concerts at school? I mean, like within the context of school?
Oh, yeah. School concerts, we did your normal two or three a year. We did them in a gymatorium and very well attended, packed every time. And that was, not a problem. With the jazz big band, though, if we played on compound, we could do it indoors. We could not play outdoors because there were Saudi citizens that lived in our community. So we couldn't do anything outdoors. If we played outside the compound, it kind of had to be on the down low. So we wouldn't publish anything. It was all word of mouth. Until, like I said, about 7 years in, things started to open up. And the new prince, however you may feel about him, he was trying to open some things up, and music was one of them. And so the jazz band got invited to perform at a jazz festival in Jeddah, and that was in an auditorium supported by KAUST, is the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. And they ran the festival, and it was like one of the first of its kind in decades. And then our final year before COVID hit, we had the chance to perform a sold-out show. It was absolutely amazing at the ITHRA, Center for World Culture. It is a gorgeous building, gorgeous auditorium, brand new, like 800-seat professional theater. And the band played there, sold out, expats, Saudis were in the audience. And it was, you know, ovations for a long time, because I think it was something for some of the Saudi citizens, it's like, hey, I've never heard anything like this before live. So it was amazing.
So it sounds like you really witnessed firsthand a lot of growth and a lot of, you know, cultural evolution while you were living in Saudi. Would you agree?
Yes. While we were there, like, for example, on compound, my wife could drive. Off compound, she couldn't. Mm-hmm. On compound, she could dress modestly. Even I wasn't supposed to wear shorts in like a public company facility. And off compound, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that anyway. But then again, and then when she went off compound, she had to cover up and initially wear an abaya and something covering her hair. But then that sort of relaxed and it was just the abaya. So there's some, you know, lots of shifts. She was able to drive our last year there off compound. So yeah, things were opening up. And the music thing we were talking about, the day that I noticed there was definitely a change was I went to our favorite sushi restaurant and we're sitting there eating. And I was like, gosh, my wife, Christine, like, something's different. What's going on? Like, I feel, and she's like, there's music playing. I was like,
oh, wow,
you're right. There's music in the background. And that little thing was like, oh. And then very soon after that, we started to hear about local musicians performing at cafes, you know, doing an acoustic set or something.
That's really powerful. It's funny, earlier when I first asked you this question and you said, yeah, no background music in restaurants, no background music in malls. And I was thinking, that's so subtle. That's the kind of thing that you don't even think about until it's not there. And that's exactly the way you described it. You know, you didn't even think about it until it was there. And then you couldn't even put your finger on what it was. Let's take another short break, but we'll be right back to talk more with my guest, musician and international educator, Brian White. If you like what you hear on The Listen, I'd love to help you and your family tell your own story. Hearing stories about those we love helps us to better understand the trajectory of our lives. I'll help you craft a recording of your memories, all in your own words. It's the perfect gift for grandchildren, parents, and partners. For more information, contact me through our website at thelistenpodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and be sure to join our Facebook group, the Listen Podcast Community. And if you'd like to make a donation to the show or pitch a guest, you can reach out to us through our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking with my guest, Brian White, about the experiences that have made up his career as a musician. Brian, before we go on, why don't you let our listeners know where they can find you, and we'll be sure to include that information in our show notes as well.
So I have an Instagram band, just like a band, B-A-N-D dot director dot Brian. And then I have a YouTube channel where I've kind of posted recordings of my time in Singapore and some of the big band stuff. And that's not a cool name, but it's Brian White 79.
Okay, cool. So Instagram and YouTube are the best places to find you?
Yes.
Cool. And I will include links to both of those things in our show notes so people can find you.
Okay.
I'm curious Thanks. About your COVID year. You referenced, you know, what happened to me and some other organizations during COVID.
Yeah.
And we know you recently ended up in Italy, but where were you from March 2020 until you guys moved to Milan?
Right. So we had decided to leave Saudi in December and turned in our letter of intent that we were going to leave. And then COVID hit in March. And luckily, I mean, our country was completely closed down, but luckily our company let us stay in our house, even though we were supposed to leave on July 1st. They didn't kick us out because we had nowhere to go. We couldn't get out. And then it wasn't until September 7th that we were able to leave Saudi Arabia. And the plan was already to take a year off. We had thought about doing that between after our time in Singapore, but then the Saudi Arabia job popped open, and I had been recommended by a colleague through Ami that I would be a great replacement for him, and that all just sort of worked out. And so we moved to Saudi and didn't take the gap year. And we decided after Saudi to go for it. And so when we could finally get out in September, the two places that were available to Americans to go that wasn't America, because we wanted to save some money and not spend in America, you know, expensive. Mm-hmm. So it was Albania and Ecuador. And ironically, Ecuador was the place we were already planning on going to. So everything worked out. We were able to get to Ecuador to a city called Cuenca, which just like where you're at.
City.
Yes.
Yep.
A beautiful city up in the mountains, about 9,000 feet, four rivers running through it, temperate weather because it's high, but it's also near the equator. So it sort of balances itself out. And Ecuador is an amazing country with incredible food because you've got it, while it's, you've got so many different climates there, like the coast, the mountains, the they have, yeah, so you get the tropical fruits you can get there, super fresh, super cheap. So we spent a year in Cuenca, Ecuador, homeschooling my son. So I did health and PE and science and social studies and obviously music, and my wife did the other core subjects. And that was the bulk of our mornings. But in the afternoons, I did I studied jazz improv. I got online with a teacher, a composer and teacher. Benjamin Dean Taylor writes fantastic music of all different levels. He and I became good friends. But I'd study jazz lessons with jazz trumpet and theory. And then that sort of morphed into it. I'd been having a Mr. Holland's Opus sort of crisis with a piece I started like 10 years ago and could never finish. And it was happened to be a jazz big band piece. So he helped me work through that. So our jazz lessons turned into jazz composition lessons. And I was able to finally able to finish that. And just taking it slow, you know, enjoying. And I don't know if we'll talk later about like how to get into international teaching, but recruiting happens really early. And because of COVID, it happened even earlier. So we had just got to Ecuador in September, and right at the beginning of October, we already started getting nibbles and hearing about schools that were, and again, through the AMI organization, a gentleman who had taught at the American School in Milan was contacted by an administrator and said, "Hey, we're looking for someone. Who can you recommend?" And he's like, "Oh, I know this guy named Brian. I think he's great, and I know he's looking for a job." And they got a hold of me, and so I already had the job by November 1st. Of 2019. So
no,
then the whole
2020,
rest.
2020, right? Because that was 2020. During COVID.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Sorry about that. So 2020. So then I had the rest of the year sort of like, not to relax, but to just know, okay, I've got a job.
Yeah.
And I don't have to worry. You know, I know that after this year, we've got some place to go.
And your wife is getting a teacher too, right?
Yes. Yes. She is a fantastic elementary teacher, and she's also got a background in music. She was a music therapist for a while, and this year she's teaching sixth grade, and she's filling in for a maternity leave. So yeah, everything worked out, and now we're in Milan.
Oh,
so it's been
amazing.
Awesome.
So Brian, you've mentioned Singapore, you've mentioned Saudi Arabia, you've mentioned Ecuador. Now you guys are in Milan, which is all over the world, but that's living and, you know, being in one place and working. What about travel? Can you tell us about any trips you've taken from those home bases?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, we could spend the next 2 hours because, you know, as far as like to be an international teacher, one of the appeals is the chance to travel. I think for younger listeners that can be a little dangerous because the idea is, oh, I'm going to go teach overseas so I can travel. You got to realize you're going overseas. They're hiring you for you to teach. And that's your primary, that's what you have to do. And that's what you're being paid to do. And that needs to be the priority. And then you travel. But Singapore was such an easy place to travel from and see all of Southeast Asia. My son, you know, we talked about three continents. He's a third culture. I think he's already got 25 or 26 stamps in his passports.
Wow.
From all the traveling we've done. So, I mean, Southeast Asia, you name it, we've done it. And we've seen all the big things. We've been to Bali 7 times because when we'd fly back to the U.S., Singapore Airlines, you'd get enough points to travel. And it just so happened you could get to Bali for free. So we've done that, you know, Vietnam, Thailand, China, you know. We've trekked in Nepal in the mountains there. We trekked in the mountains of northern India. We've, you know, learned to scuba dive. It's been absolutely amazing. And then in Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, we didn't travel as much as we probably should have in the country itself. We tended to, when we had our breaks, want to get out. I don't know what that says about Saudi, but it was just, you know, it can be, what's the right word? Some of the comforts that you're used to, you don't always get in Saudi. So when you have a long holiday, you tend to get out. And we would go to Europe a lot.
Well, and also, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, but, you know, hearing you talk about the things your wife could do and couldn't do on compound and off compound, I mean, that must have been hard. That must have been hard for both of you guys.
At first, I mean, for her, yes, because she's very, you know, she's a strong-willed woman and speaks her mind. And she had a hard time, I think, in the beginning, biting her tongue with some things she was seeing. But like I said, it started to, you know, things would ease up. And most of our time in Saudi was spent on the compound. It was, I mean, like I said, it's a 10 or 11,000 person compound. So when I say compound, it's big. It's a little, I mean, it's a city. And we had restaurants and cafes and bowling alleys. And there was an 18-hole golf course that had grass, beautiful green grass in the middle of the desert. So, you know, and they have, the company sets up lots of community activities. Like if you have like the big band, you know, if you have an interest and you can find enough people, they'll support you creating something. And so your time in Saudi, rather than traveling as much, was spent more inwards. And we had so many dinner parties and the community groups. I sang in a madrigal group there. I'd never done that before. So a different sort of enjoyment experience in Saudi than like Singapore. It's like, hey, there's a budget airline. Let's go to Lombok for the weekend. Okay.
You said that the trips you did take from your base in Saudi were more to Europe, for example?
Yeah, we like to do like the German Christmas markets at wintertime. It's hard traveling back to the States for a Christmas break. The vacation schedule for an oil company is very different than a regular teacher, and too convoluted to explain here. But if the students were gone on vacation, that didn't mean we actually had time off.
Okay,
we had company paid holidays just like every other employee. So sometimes, you know, you could choose to travel at Christmas time and take your 2 or 3 weeks, but then you didn't get that time in the summer. So we usually took shorter things and did the Christmas markets, or we'd fly to Amsterdam. It was kind of wherever, because we only had 3 airlines near us that were direct flights to Europe. Otherwise, there are lots of convoluted rides you'd have to take to get back to place. So a lot of trips to Europe. And then, you know, Dubai, Oman, lots of trips to Bahrain, because there's an easy, you just drive over the border. So if you wanted to go to a hotel and have a drink, You could drive to Bahrain and do that.
Okay. Okay. What about South America? Did you guys take any trips while you were based in Ecuador?
No, it was COVID year. So that was the original intent, to make that our home base. But traveling outside of Ecuador just got really tricky. And we did do a beach trip and some hikes. Cuenca is right up near the Cajas National Parks up in the mountains. And so we did hikes in the mountains, but kind of just, you know, staying at home and enjoying time together as a family and not so much traveling.
Right. And I mean, you said it was COVID year. So before we finish up, I wonder if you have any advice for our listeners out there who might be excited to embark on a career like the one that you have carved out, whether as a musician or as a teacher, as an international teacher, as a band director. What steps would you say they should take to get started down that path?
Right. Well, the whole environment of recruiting has been changing ever since I started. Early on, it was you must go to a recruiting fair. And that was pretty much the only way to get connected with the school. So there's some big ones out there. One of them's called Search Associates. And I would start there. They have a massive database that once you subscribe, and it is a fee-based subscription, you can get access to the database so you can learn about the different schools and then find out what jobs are posted. There's another, the other big recruiter is ISS-Schroll, and I think that's S-C-H-R-O-L-E. Again, that's another sort of fee-based subscription. Search Associates gives you an associate that you're connected with that you can contact and get advice from. ISS Schroll is just, you sign up, you get access to their database, and the schools can find out about you as well because you upload all of your information. And then there's a new one out of Dubai, and GRC Fair, Global Recruitment Something Fair, is the one out of Dubai, and that one is free. You sign up for that, and you can, and again, it's basically getting access to a database where schools can see you and you can see them. And a lot of jobs will pop up, and you can get messages through there. So for brand new teachers out of college, it sounds really cool and exciting, but most international schools want teachers with experience. So originally, when I first started, Search Associates said a minimum of 3 years before they'll even look at your stuff. And I don't know if that's still the case. Having said that, music teachers aren't as, like, an elementary classroom teacher, this sounds terrible, but in the recruiting, they're a dime a dozen. I mean, they're all over the place. And to get a job as an elementary, it ends up usually being, like, you're paired up, especially if you have a partner. So that's another big tip. Like, if you are willing to, if you're married, awesome, you have a girlfriend or boyfriend or significant other that you can go together and you're both teachers, highly recruitable because they can kill two birds with one stone. Like, you know, we have a PE and a science position open at our school. And if they can hire one couple and take care of both those, they'll do that, right? So if you're single, but you've got a really good friend that wouldn't mind staying in the same apartment with you, because some schools will pay for housing. So it saves them money hiring two people that'll stay together rather than two separate.
Okay. Well, all that's great information. And again, we will include those links in our show notes so people can find them easily and, you know, click on them and explore and see what they can find. Brian, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been great to hear about your experiences and to get a little advice from you. And so thank you so much for sharing your time. And I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, Kate. I really have enjoyed talking. I'm so passionate about, obviously, music and international teaching. It's been such an amazing experience that I love talking about it, as you could tell. So if any of your listeners who are music teachers want to contact me, I'd love to help out and give them more advice if they need it.
Well, we encourage our listeners to reach out to you either through your social media or through us. If they want to drop us a line, we can put them in touch with you.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Kelly Shepherd, an American music teacher and choir conductor who's currently based in Brisbane, Australia. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain. just miles from Villar de Domingo García, home to an astounding archaeological site containing the largest figurative Roman mosaic found to date. I want to thank Lisa Dahl, our web guru, and Julie Haley, who handles our social media. And many thanks to our technical team, John Jetmore and Lucas Munoz Jetmore, who make sure the show is ready to go each week. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.